Dublin.
Welcome everyone to Studio Soundtracks, the monthly program that takes listeners behind the scenes of making music for film and television. I'm your host, Chandler Poling. On today's show, it's all about outstanding music for television, and with me are two of the Emmy-nominated composers being celebrated this season. Welcome to the program, Carlos Rafael Rivera and Martin Phipps.
Thank you. Hi. Thanks for having us.
Hi, Chandler. Great to
Hi.
Be here.
Hi. Thanks so much for being here, guys. I'm really excited to have you both on the show today. Your work as composers is phenomenal and celebrated by so many people. Congrats on your recent Emmy nominations. You must be so excited.
Yes.
Yep.
Yeah, I'm very excited. Congratulations, man.
Very excited.
Congratulations, Martin, man.
Congratulations, Carlos. Yeah, fantastic.
All deserved.
I'm glad, I'm glad we're not in the same category. That's all I can say.
Same here. Yeah. Same here. I don't know if I told you this, and I don't know if I'm getting ahead of anything, but my wife loves the show so much. She watches it all the time. And I was like working because this is like the dining room. The studio is like was the dining room of the house, you know, and it just slowly has become a studio. And I'm working here and then like life is happening right outside the door. And my wife was watching, you know, the show, and I started hearing this music come over, and I had to get up, you know, and I went, what is that? You know, and she's like, oh, it's The Crown. I was like, holy crap, this is so good. And she's not a musician, but she talks about, you know, we've been together forever, and she's like, I just love the layers. It's just so layered, and it's just the layers, and it builds and builds. And so anyways, I just wanted to share that with you because it obviously made an impression at home. So congratulations, man.
Carlos, that makes it. That's really, really lovely. It's for a lonely composer. That's a lovely thing to hear.
It's true. It's absolutely true, dude.
Yeah,
absolutely
true. Yeah.
Now, have you guys met before?
Only on another panel. Yeah, we did a panel. Yeah.
Well, was it? Sounds quick.
No,
I'm glad that you guys get a chance to kind of meet more closely over the show.
Yeah. Well, I'd love to try and come out in September, but I don't know if that's going to be possible from Plague Island, Britain.
You know, we don't know either. It's mysterious.
Right.
It's unknown. So for listeners who might not be familiar, Carlos is nominated for The Queen's Gambit and Martin is nominated for The Crown. And I'm just going to put this out there. In an alternate reality, I'm not saying that you guys didn't do amazing work on your own, but in an alternate reality, I feel like your scores could have been for each other's projects, because you think of The Crown and the monarchy and all this royal lush orchestra, and then you think of the drug-induced kind of chess tournament of Beth Harmon, and, you know, Carlos's score could easily have gone into The Crown and Martin's score could have easily gone into The Queen's Gambit, but that's not the way it went, which is great, because your filmmakers went in a different direction and for really good reason. So I want to start with you, Martin, with Peter Morgan. What sort of direction were you given? Why not live in this kind of lush, orchestral, royal kind of feeling? And why go into this more modern kind of textural, electronic hybrid score?
Peter Morgan, who's the showrunner and kind of basically the boss of everything, he would never have let me write a score with as many notes as the fantastic Queen's Gambit score's got in it. Even if I could write that many notes, he wouldn't let me. And he's all about not restraint, but keeping it very pared back and kind of as simple as possible, with, as Carlos points out, with layers on it. But it's his main direction, his biggest note when we first started was he wanted subdued power. He wanted a sense of great power and establishment, but without being ever really breaking through and being in your face. It was always sort of off stage. It was kind of lurking in the background, building slowly. And that was his main note to start off with. But he never actually really ever said, I want these instruments, or, you know, you can use this or you can't use this. It was much more about the sort of overall emotional effect of the music.
That's brilliant. Yeah. Cause it definitely comes across that kind of subtle, powerful music that you write for it. And also just the emotions of Diana throughout the season really stand out. And again, you don't overplay it. You know, you definitely have this amazing kind of subtle score that supports it so well. And then Carlos, what about you? I mean, you confessed in a previous interview that you were scoring the wrong story and you had to start over. So were you going more in a dark kind of drug induced mood and you're like, this is it. Cause she's, you know, she's drinking and high on pills and she's winning chess tournaments. So this is obviously the grit that we need.
Yeah.
So talk a little bit about that.
It was, the problem really was getting in at the beginning, because it felt like we were kind of scoring or assembling an order chronologically. So it was episode one, and it was the first assembly of episode one was nearly 2 hours, you know? And so there was a couple problems that happened. Was that, first of all, there was one sort of, it felt like it was one movie and just one entire story on its own. And so there was like a nearsightedness that started to happen with me, because the direction was piano only and it made sense in that room. But one of the things that happened, one of the mistakes was basically that I had scored a 2 hour, you know, the assembly, but as they edited it down, I wasn't looking at the big arc. So suddenly cues that were like, you know, within 5 minutes of each other were nearly 20 seconds apart now. So it felt like there was a lot of music that wasn't doing any service to the story itself. And so we had our preview and I had been just busily editing down, cutting to, you know, all the cues to the new assembly without thinking, you know, it's only an hour now. And I sat down and they sent a link for everybody to look at, like, and that night, dude, I looked at my wife and I was like, oh, this is not good. My stomach started turning about like 20 minutes in, because similar music was playing and it felt like it was just bad, you know? And that was one of the two sort of big problems that I had. And then, and the next day, Carl, you know, Scott Frank calls me and he goes, Carlos, he said a different word. I'm not going to say it because of the podcast, but basically he said, you're kind of screwed, aren't you? And I go, yep, I am. And it was like this sort of triage of trying to just like, let's remove to help. And then one of the biggest lessons I also learned about that first episode going from 2 hours to one was, if a cue, the shorter the cue is, the less service it does. You know, it's almost like, and so you have to start thinking of, if a music is coming in, it's for a reason and it has to stay a while to kind of help the story have weight. And that was one of the things, because it became a lot of like 5 second cues, 10 second cues, and it felt very not good, you know. So that was one of the harder things to kind of get through, apart from the fact that the games themselves were like I had mentioned before, and like the other interview thing is that I was not understanding how to approach the games. And I was just doing a thing called game music in my mind. You know, it was just music for every time. It's going to be the same kind of music. And it was just a fail. And to the point that Scott called me and said, Carlos, you're scoring the wrong story. So, you know, that's always like, you know, nerve wracking, but it's good too, because you grow, you know, you learn, you're like, you have to find a way, you know, if you don't get fired, that's a good thing. That means you found something, you know, so that's the hope.
Yeah, it just shows that when you are in a situation like that and you are not hitting the right notes, so to speak, that, you know, your filmmaker has enough trust that you can deliver. Because obviously what happened as an end result is that we have a fantastic score that obviously fits the story and everything. So, you know, it's I think it's important for people to hear that composers, they don't always hit lightning strikes and then it comes right out and then it's magic and everybody's happy and everything, that there's a lot of revisions and there's a lot of process in writing a hit score. And Martin, did you have any challenges, any situation where you were just like, oh, I'm not doing this right?
Sure. I mean, look, it's great for Carlos to give that insight to that process. And yeah, just not being fired is a win. For sure. And that's true. You can pat yourself on the back just to get through. I mean, I have huge respect for anyone who gets anything on screen and ends up in a film and kind of works. So
cheers to that.
So I didn't have the same challenge in that, you know, I was joining a show that was already well established and a big hit. So that, you know, that being on that first, finding the world, finding the language of a film or a series is a really tough bit, and I skipped all of that. So again, big respect for being there from the beginning. But my challenge, I guess, was sort of following on from Rupert, Gregson Williams and Hans Zimmer, which was had its own challenges. And I think it was, I was quite nervous about the whole taking on the whole thing. I mean, I'd never actually not started a series before. I usually always, you know, that's finding that world is the bit where you go through that painful process, but it's a necessary one. And so it felt like a strange thing to be coming in. But Peter Morgan was sort of clear that he wanted something different from what they'd had before, and that he had come to me, you know, he gave me enough confidence to feel that it was, that I wasn't just going to be trying to end up kind of copying them or doing something too similar, and could find my own language. So yeah, but it was really nerve-wracking at the front, partly because basically, you know, we could have got to season three and they could have just tempted up with seasons one and two, you know, into the edit, and it would have worked beautifully because the music was great in the first two seasons, and but different, but still, but great. And I could have just hit that, seen the first cut, and it could have been wall to wall, Rupert Gregson Williams and Lorne Balfe, and that wouldn't have been nice. But really, luckily, they didn't do that. They were very, very sort of strict with themselves, and I wrote a whole load of stuff early on. Like right before, just as soon as they started filming, I wrote like a sort of album's worth of material and gave it to them, and they pretty much edited with that. Yeah, and that was a real, wow. That was a real win for me, and a lovely way to work. And you know, then it's sort of organic from the beginning, and the editors are working to it. And these were tracks that I could give them their own rhythm and their own pace. I wasn't chasing someone else's pace or scene construction or chasing an edit that was changing. And that process has just gone on. It got more in season four, and it got to the stage where I was delivering. I delivered stuff again when they were filming and came back to it, you know, as the episodes got nearly complete. And often I would try and change stuff and they would just go, no, I don't like what you've done. You know, we just like what you gave us, that crap demo that you gave us early on, you know, which I thought was like sort of basic on the Casio keyboard. That was that's what we liked. Did lots of big orchestral recording. I don't like that, you know, that's too that's too plush, that's too ordinary. We like your little demo you did. So great, also a little frustrating at times, but a really interesting and unusual process.
It's a great problem to have too. I mean,
it is a good problem, right.
Yeah, it's awesome.
But weird in a way not to be. I mean, I did whole episodes where I came back and rescored them, and it was, you know, often kind of chucked out almost completely, and just like, no, we you know, as far as Peter Morgan's concerned, when they locked the edit with my tracks in it, that was kind of it. He was happy, I'm going, but hang on, you know, these haven't even got proper endings on them, or they're sort of just little rough ideas that haven't been developed. They don't go anywhere. He's like, no, that's, I like that.
If it works, it works. The thing is, I guess it just works, right?
Well, I think it's very much, if you have faith in the person who's leading the whole project, then you go with it. And I do. And so I didn't resent that stuff being chucked out, because I kind of knew he knew what was going on. And if anyone knew it, he knew it. And it was like, in him we trust. So yeah, it was a bit like that.
In him we trust. I love that.
Well, let's listen to a piece from The Crown. This is a track titled Fairy Tale.
Thank you.
Now, Martin, you were previously nominated for a Primetime Emmy for your score to Victoria, which also uses female voice, which we also just heard in Fairy Tale. What draws you to female voice? Like, why? What stands out to you about it?
I mean, voices are really tricky in music. They're a sort of, if you can manage to find a place for them, then it's a really they're such a strong flavor. I mean, they're the most sort of organic of all instruments. They're us. They're like people talking themselves, even though they might not be singing words. It's almost like a dialogue. But they're very hard to get in, and they're really hard to sort of make sit in a show, because they will naturally jump out at you and be a very strong flavor. But I can't help trying, and I quite often failed and sort of, you know, moved away from it. But I just love them. I mean, I've always trying to get voices in, and I did a version of War and Peace with a Russian, or it was actually Latvian choir, sort of male voice choir, and that was, you know, that was great. That was one of my favorite jobs. Yeah. And most satisfying ones. They're very rewarding when they work, but as I say, they're not always easy.
Right. Yeah. And that's a great callback to War and Peace. If anybody that is listening that would like to go back, you should definitely go find War and Peace by Martin Phipps. That's a wonderful score. At the top of the show, we heard the main title from The Queen's Gambit. And Carlos, I wanted to know, how does a piece like that end up at the end of the show? Was it originally intended for a scene at the top, or did you always know that it was going to just round out the show and end it all?
Because the director says so. No, I literally never thought it was going to be at the end. When I wrote it, I certainly was thinking, you know, I did the same process for the previous thing I'd done with Scott called Godless. And when that happened, he wrote an email saying, oh, this is fantastic, I'm so excited. And I remember during the post-production of Godless, at some point he considered getting rid of it, like altogether, like just no main title. It's just because of the length of the show, it maybe takes you out of the story. He wasn't really sure about it, but thank God it survived, because it helped personally for the career thing. But then when this one came about, the same thing happened. You know, it was like December, he hadn't started shooting yet. You know, it was like 2018, December of 2018. And I sent the main title as the first demo. It was basically piano and timpani. And he's like, oh, this is great. And I just assumed, but then right as post started, he was like, I'm not going to have any main title sequence. And I was like, wait, what? You know, because, you know, selfishly, you want to have a main title, because I grew up as a kid watching main title shows. Mm-hmm. That was everything. It's like the invitation to the party kind of thing. And it, for me, it always had like, it was its own little thing, because it's like, dude, you got to check this out. You know, that's the job of the main title. And so I was like, but I never, ever brought it up to him. I never said, hey, wait a second. Wouldn't it be nice? You know, I always let him, like you said, in him we trust, Martin. You know, yeah. I really, these are petty things, because ultimately it's a selfish endeavor, right? If I go and ask, you know, so I just let it kind of play out. And he goes, I think it's going to play, you know what, it'll play at the end of the series. And one of the reasons is because in Netflix, you know, when the show ends, it skips to the next one until the last episode. The last episode titles play all the way through without skipping, like for the of the show. Mm-mm. I didn't either. And then, but so he has a main title ending. The artsy stuff all happens at the end, along with the main title. So it was called The Main on End, you know. And so, but for me, it kind of worked out. I'm just happy that I got to have it. At some point, he even considered replacing the main title with different music. And I never, ever told him, hey, no, you don't understand, man. Like, the whole show is based on these little elements. Like, because again, he's the leader, and you're seeing him.
Yeah,
and they don't care. They don't care for them.
The
joke I make to the students, because I've been doing Zoom for like ever, is like, music is like one of those circles in this. No, nobody can see it on your podcast, sorry, but it's like on this little stupid pillow I have. Like, that's music, and then the show is the whole room. You know, so for me to talk about the way that circle thing is, and he doesn't, you know, he's worried about VFX, you know, the editing isn't working, the color, whatever it is that he's worried about. So I never, ever, I've learned, you know, just unless you really think it's important for the story, to argue for story. But if you're doing something that's ultimately selfish, don't bring it up. So I didn't. And it still survived. So I'm grateful for that.
I ended up in a sort of ridiculous panel discussion with an editor once about how much the music is relevant to the overall, trying to put a percentage on the, and we were sort of arguing. I was saying, I think I was ridiculously saying like 20% or something, which was just, you know, which is just shows the overinflated kind of thing of a composer at that stage. He was kind of trying to say 10 and we ended up somewhere in between. But it, I think music can change. It can change a scene hugely.
Yeah.
But in the end, if the acting isn't good and it doesn't look great, and you know, it doesn't matter how good the music is, it's no one's going to watch it and no one's going to enjoy it. So,
truth. And that's a truth.
Yeah, it's a testament to both of your shows, because everything is 100% on point and everything's working well together. The costume, the acting, the camera, the music, you know, when one of those things are faltering, you as an audience member, you start to lose interest, or you get a little disbelief in what you're watching because something is not working right. But in both of your shows, they work beautifully together. All the elements of the program.
Thanks.
Nice.
Now, Martin, did you ever try to tackle the main title? Did you ever go, "Hey, I've got a great idea. Let's get rid of Hans."
I did. Towards the end of season three, I did just, you know, "Hey, how about this?" You know, it's like, and they were all the execs were really polite and were like, pretended that they were sort of thinking about it for a while. then, you know, it's like, "Oh, we love it so much, but, you know, everyone knows the other one and familiarity and everything." So yeah, exactly. Carlos, I haven't got a lot of sympathy for you because, you know, I haven't even got I've got someone else doing the main title. So that's, that's hard to swallow.
Yeah. No, it's true though. I mean, I also want to address something you said, Chandler, though, that it is true that I think the education for me in this show was the level of the quality control on all fronts, like sound and stuff, to watch that. I'm sure it is for you, Martin. You're getting these scenes that are just so gorgeous, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And it's such a privilege, to be part of that. You know, you really, that's why we don't complain when we get material like that. It's like, we'll do whatever it takes to make that work, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. And a lot of the job to a certain degree is easier, but you are aware. There are moments, especially with Wiley Stateman, who's the sound designer for this show, who we called Obi-Wan Kenobi, and you can just look him up on IMDb and you'll see why. It's just like, that's one of the funnest things to listen to him talk about things, because it's like a totally different perspective, but it's the same world you're inhabiting space wise. And so there's a lot of handoff and a lot of that, but the cinematography, and I'm speaking of both shows, you know, the costume design, the acting, it's you do have moments where you look at it and you feel like it's a little it's more artful than entertaining, you know. Mm-hmm. Especially The Crown, I feel it really is, to me it just breaks through in a very strong way that way. So
Carlos, can I just ask, with the sound designer and the sound and the mix generally, how do you find it works with you? I mean, are you there? Do you argue your corner? Do you get frustrated mean, I've got a massive respect. It's this guy's a boom here who do all the Crown stuff and always get nominated every year, sort of like clockwork for it. And they're brilliant, but there is that thing, and it's not just them, it's almost every show I've ever worked on where they will Foley everything. You know, everything will have a sound effect, and I will be working to a cut or an edit where the sound is quite minimal and often, in the Crown's case, quite carefully chosen. And then we'll get to the mix and suddenly everything has a new sound effect and everything is wall-to-wall effects. And it's a sort of, it's a tricky one, because that's not what I've scored, or, you know, that's not how I've worked. And especially if you're trying to be quite restrained with the music and have the space in it to suddenly, you know, have a distracting, you know, there was one scene where Diana just arrived at the palace and was alone, sort of feeling lonely in her room, and And behind her, there's a maid putting stuff away, and all you could hear was the maid clunking around and putting stuff in, pulling these drawers in and out. And I was just like, "What? You know, really?
Who cares?"
I mean, it's a great effect, but is that really what we're concentrating on right now?
Yeah, but those are the actual artifacts from that year, 1980 something, right?
Exactly.
You
know, that's the Mike and Foley. That wardrobe, those cupboard drawers.
They went into Buckingham Palace and opened the drawers themselves.
Exactly. And Mike did. It's a hell of a library. You got to get it yourself. But the thing that I think this all started from Wiley in Godless. Wiley started the idea of doing what's called a rolling mix. So he wanted, and he pushed me, is like, you know, if the music can be as close to finished as possible, our sound will be the sound. It is the sound. It's not going to be replaced later. It's not a temporary soundtrack. It is the sound. And so by the time Scott sees it, and this is really to help Scott, you know, like he wants to, Scott also was the one who's like, I don't want temp music and I don't want, you know, temp sound. I want to experience this where it's at, no matter where it's at, 60%, 80%. And Wiley really pushed for that. And so the sound he worked on it throughout.
He was sort of giving it a rolling mix.
Nonstop. So that's why it feels so, you know, and I've learned from, you know, I've only been working for the last, like, you know, 8 years now, like, and, you know, and only with Scott up until this year, right? And it's what I'd heard through many friends, though, who have been doing this for a while, is that usually it's like you duke it out at the dub stage, right, with sound. And my experience has been the opposite. Now, what I've actually done in the last shows I've had a few conversations with sound designers, but there is no real interaction. It's more like being on a panel with somebody, right? Except our conversation today. Mm-hmm. But I've learned to not be as precious, because it ultimately does, you know, I mean, I've been lucky to have the space to be precious with Wiley and Scott in the mixing place. We all have notes. We all give notes. Mm. We're also careful not to, you know, just because you're the guitarist in the band, you want your guitar to be louder. You know, it's not.
You've got to be
careful
not to always just be pushing the sound. Yeah, more music.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. And so there's been that, but that's also because I'm 50. If 20 years ago, I'd have been like, you don't understand. Mm. You know, you got to hear the harp. And
yeah.
Like, what?
Yeah. Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Nobody cares.
You're not really having that dialogue that loud, are you? That's what I used to say. Yeah. You don't need to hear. You don't need to hear that dialogue. Really? Do you need to? It's not that important.
Have you heard my melody, guys? Like, nobody cares, man. So that's the thing. Yeah. The indifference. It's balancing that indifference they actually have towards the fact that what we do is no different than costume design or set design for them. They're like, I don't like that. I don't want to hear it. I don't like. Yeah. Just change it. And that's what we do.
Yeah,
absolutely. Well, let's hear some music from The Queen's Gambit. I'm going to put a track on called Ceiling Games. Thank you. Carlos, can you talk a little bit about getting into the head of Beth Harmon? Because she has these visions on the ceiling of her matches or of various ways of strategy to play chess. So what kind of led you to kind of get into that mindset?
Well, I'll preface by saying that it sounds like I intended everything, but the truth is it was a discovery as we were going. But one thing that started to kind of become apparent as we were stuck in episode one, you know, working on that long one, is that when she started looking at the ceiling and playing the games, even in the book, in the novel itself, I always read it like ominous. Like it always, the word ominous is the word that like kept, you know, there was, I kind of saw a point of view from the ceiling through chess pieces down to Beth. And I loved that image, the way it worked in the book. And Scott really translated that well. And I think they took forever to get that right for them, for Scott to be happy. And it was worth the work, you know, because it's somehow believable in this very unbelievable scenario. But with that in mind, I started thinking, well, the music in the ceiling it has to be not the reality. It has to be. And since her reality is just piano, you know, what she sees in the ceiling is hopefully orchestral. And so it started to feel that way, like it needed to be orchestral. So it started to become a thing once we got into episode two, that she gets adopted and she leaves the room, the world she's in, it becomes a bigger world. So we needed to add color. So I started adding instrumentation like flutes and other things. And we kept growing as the episodes grew. And I started thinking, well, wait a second, what if, you know, by the end of the show, end of episode seven, her reality is the thing she was looking at in the ceiling, because that's how it is when you're a kid. You're imagining things and you're dreaming the dream or whatever. And then you grow up and life happens at you and you're like, there's no dream. Sorry. I had to go dark there. Sorry. But the truth is like, yeah. But in movies, it happens all the time, you know? So so the fact is to get to the end, you know, that was the goal. And Scott was approving the cues, which is the most important thing. You know, he was like, oh yeah, this works. You know, he did have a couple of notes on the first versions of Ceiling Games, but they were more like notes, not revisions, like this isn't right. So it felt like the ceiling stuff was always kind of close to where it needed to be. It was a sense of ominosity. No, it was ominous. I don't know how to use it as an, you know, active word, but it felt that way. It needed to be ominous. So, and yeah. That's sort of the best way I can explain it.
And Martin, on the same topic of getting into a character's head, you had Diana to work with on this season. And one of the tracks that I'll play in a little bit is your track called The Diana Effect. But just talk a little bit about writing music for somebody that you probably grew up knowing and very familiar with, and the emotions that go with kind of writing musically her story.
Yeah, it's interesting. I don't, on The Crown, it hasn't been very literal in terms of assigning themes to characters. And quite often, it was more about doing stuff that worked with the world of The Crown and the world of the establishment and this subdued power that was off stage and this feeling of the sense of power that surrounded this family and it, as a nation, how it, you know, the power it has over the nation. But having said that, Diana was obviously a massively new character in season four, and we couldn't sort of help score her differently. And although I didn't want to get sort of sidetracked by it's the 80s, I'm going to bring out my synths and we're going to have a great time, much as I would love to do that. But I did a bit, and it was lovely to get some real electronic kind of brightness into it and pulse and stuff that was so, you know, really not overtly orchestral or even sort of hybrid, but quite clearly kind of synthesized sound. And so that was really fun, and to do something really, it was a whole thing about her sort of breezing into this family and kind of forcing her way in. It was like this massive breath of fresh air and modernity. And so that was kind of reflected in that track, and which we didn't actually use that often. It was only a couple of times sort of when Diana's really flying high And it was about the kind of Beatlemania, the adoration for her that we wanted to embody with that track. But otherwise, again, we were often sort of quite subdued with her and would keep it very simple, just harp and a little bit of voices here and there.
And did you personally have any sort of feelings about writing for the character of Diana? Do you have any like memories or stories?
I mean, I absolutely do. My overarching memory is like, what is going on here? Why is it? I mean, when she died, I just didn't get it at all. I just was like, I was away, in fact, and we came back and it was like the world had gone mad. And so it's weird. I don't have any feelings about that. And I don't have any feelings about the royal family. I'm genuinely not a royalist at all. And I'm not ardently a Republican either. I don't want, as in a Republican in our British sense, not an American sense. I'm not anti-monarchy and you know, chop their heads off at all either. I think they have a place, and I've sort of begun to understand that having worked on The Crown, and I think that's what The Crown explains very well about why we sort of need that in a strange and messed up way. But I actually personally, the characters don't mean much to me, you know, in real life. That how Peter Morgan presents them is a totally another thing, because I think they reflect bits of ourselves and as an English person, as very much bits of our society and the way we have a sort of strange class-ridden hierarchy, and that's really well exposed, and it just reflects back on ourselves really well. But actually them historically as characters and then right, I don't have much feeling. Margaret Thatcher, on the other hand, I definitely did have more of a feeling about, but that was a kind of, that's a different story. So.
Yeah. Also great, you know, music and scenes with Gillian Anderson as Margaret Thatcher. Fantastic work.
Right. Which was fantastic. But sort of almost deliberately not a theme for her. You know, no. We used a couple of, she had some great musical moments, but they were sort of stuff that had worked elsewhere. And it didn't feel right to give her I wouldn't know quite what to have done with that, because, you know, you always think if you give someone a theme and it's either good or bad, or it's saying something very clearly about them. And I didn't kind of want to say that about her, but it was, I don't get too tied up in the fact that the so-called historical relevance of these characters. They're just characters in a film that I'm loving, or, you know, so that's how I approach it.
Yeah. Well, let's hear it. Let's hear the Diana Effect from The Crown by Barton Phipps. Thank you. guys, I'm curious, is there a project that you would like to work on? Is there something that you're looking forward to, or something that you would just be a dream job for you?
I don't know. Just working is great. Like, for me, it's great to get to work, man. I mean, like Martin was saying earlier, you take your hat off and salute anybody who gets to credits, you know. And, I like to keep working, with people like Scott. That would be a privilege. I'd love that. And just to get to work what wouldn't I say? I mean, behind me, you guys can't see it, but I'm a super fan of Star Wars, right? So like any Star Wars project would be great. But it's just because it's been like my childhood and my obsession, like just about 99.9% of composers with John Williams and that kind of work, you know, because it's the thing that hit you when you were a kid, but not for any other reason than, you know, it's just, just work is great. You know, to get to work is great. So that's my answer, but whatever.
Yeah, Martin?
Yeah, echoing that, of just anyone who's like going to give me something good to work on is fantastic. It's about the quality of the project, not necessarily. I mean, personally, I probably should stop doing royal dramas, you know, and maybe try and branch out. It's kind of, I've almost become like the kind of royal correspondent for wars. You know,
it's like, yeah, it's so cool.
I have to admit, I'm actually doing a Princess Diana documentary, I sort of wrote before, which promises to be really good. I know there's a bucket load of them out there, but this one is really talented. Again, just talking about that, it's just really talented people. I was kind of, when they approached me, I was like, don't be ridiculous, I can't do that. I can't go from doing season 4 about Diana, have a break, do this, then go back to season 5 about Diana. But it's all archive, and it's really about how we consume her. It's not about her story. Again, it's what I was talking about earlier. It's about how we consume her and what she means to the world, to England and to the world, and so why we're obsessed about princesses and what that. So I think that's going to be great. But yeah, I'd like to probably do something just different. Some like a nice heist drama or something, a bit of genre or something.
Yeah.
So, but I doubt anyone.
Heist, dude. That, heist, you know? For sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. Heist sounds awesome, man. Yeah.
Sci-fi
heist
drama. There you go.
Yeah. Maybe if it's a heist royal drama, maybe that would be maybe a hybrid.
Carlos, you selected the final track from the Queen's Gambit called Sagraim, which means let's play in Russian. What does this track mean to you before I play it for the listeners?
Oh, it was along with the main title among the first things I wrote. And I wrote it in the, you know, starting on the book, you know, and then Scott's, you know, adaptation, the final scene where this girl, Beth, is like walking in this park and she plays and she gets recognized. But the thing was that it survived, you know, to the end of the whole show, because that was one of the first things I wrote. He had played it for some of the producers and the actors and while they were shooting it. And he had a real affinity for it. But I, you know, as has happened before, suddenly, you know, it just goes away because it doesn't belong. And melodically, it shouldn't be in the show. And that's why I like it, because it doesn't belong anywhere. There's no, like, it's not connected to anything. And when the scene came towards the end, you know, I put the track up and I was like, oh my God, it fits, but it's not, I think I have to write something new. But I did a different arrangement of the same exact idea, same melody, everything, and just a different orchestral treatment. We had found a palette for the show, you know, and then I sent it to Scott and he's like, yeah. And I was like, yes, you know, but I wasn't thinking, you know, and that's the fun thing, I think, is the personal thing for me, is that the first two things I wrote are the last two things you hear, you know, for the show. And that so it's like almost like a personal nerdy thing, not any other reason, you know. So anyway,
like a little signature at the end.
Sure, no, more like a little luck moment, you know, like it's more like lucky. Look how these two pieces are lucky pieces is the best way to put it. You know, they survived, you know.
Yeah.
For me.
Well, let's hear it. Here is Sir Graham from The Queen's Gambit. Well, we've reached the end of the show, and I'm going to ask of you what I ask everybody on this program. What was the first album you purchased, and what was the last thing you listened to?
Martin?
Oh, shit. No, you first. What are you talking about? I've got to think back a long way here.
I know.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I think I know the...
You go.
The thing is, I don't know the last thing I listened to, but I know the first thing I got was, like, I think it was a Judas Priest album. And, oh my God, I don't know if it's Screaming for Vengeance, I think, is the name of the album. But I became a fan of the Judas Priest Club because my brother was a fan of Iron Maiden. So, and he's 4 years older than me then. He still is now. And he was like, he got the Iron Maiden fan club, so I had to be on a fan club, so I became a Judas Priest fan, and I bought this album, and it was a pink album. It was like pink vinyl. That's the first thing I remember buying, like, an effort, in earnest, you know, as a big fan of Judas Priest. And then the last thing I've been, like, what do you mean, like, any genre kind of thing?
It could be your own music, but just, like, what was the last thing you listened to? It could be a podcast. It could be, you know.
Oh, news. I don't know. Like, I don't know. I mean, I've been listening to the Loki soundtrack, which I think is great, by Natalie Holt. And because I think that somehow she nailed something there that is hard to nail. So yeah, that's it.
Yeah. So I grew up with sort of pretty much as an only child. Well, I mean, I had an older brother and sister, but they were much older. And my parents were very into classical music. And so I almost listened to no, like, non-classical music till I was about 10, 11. So sort of weirdly, you know, that it's kind of, it's so weird. There's a whole, anything before like 1982, I know about, but it doesn't mean anything to me because I didn't live it at the time. So I'm going to say Star Wars, just because I'm not sure that was the first thing I had, but I remember having that soundtrack, you know, in several years before that. And the original first one, and yeah, that was pretty cool. And Minari, actually, I saw that on the weekend and have just been listening to the soundtrack since then. That's
right.
that's beautiful, really stunning. It's great beautiful. Use of music. It's great. I mean, it's Emil Rosseri.
Emil Mosseri.
Mosseri. That's it. Yeah. I thought that. I think his stuff's beautiful, and particularly on that great kind of slight element of Korean pop that he's got in there, but not really. But it's just there in the background. Is beautiful, and particularly the way that. It was one of those things I listened to on its own a while back when it sort of was up for the Oscars, and didn't really, I thought it was lovely, but it didn't really connect with me. And then I saw it win the film and it just made total sense. And now I love it.
Yes.
You know, and that's a beautiful moment when something, you know, something is, it makes sense because you've seen it with the picture, and that's what film music should be, you know.
Absolutely.
It really resonates. Yeah. So, yeah.
Great. Well, guys, thank you so much for being a part of Studio Soundtracks only on Dublab Radio. I'm going to give us a little outro music, which would be another track from The Crown. This is titled Simple Harp Variation Number 1 by Martin Phipps. So again, thank you so much, guys, for being a part of the show.
Oh, real pleasure.
Pleasure to hang out. It's been great. Thank you.